Where have all the good doctors gone?
Over 50% of physicians have communicated that they are dissatisfied with their current job. So by the end of this episode, you will understand exactly what's going on in healthcare. We predict over 100,000 physicians will leave by 2034. The number one reason why doctors are dissatisfied with their job is...
With a little health and a little wealth and a lot of love, that's the life that we live. Susan Scrubs.
Hello, everybody. I am Emily, MD. I am one of your hosts of the new podcast, Suits and Scrubs, where we will be talking about a little bit of health,
a little bit of wealth, and a lot of love.
If you did not know already, we are a married team, which brings an extra little flavor to our podcast. I will be delving into the health realm, obviously, and my partner in crime, Zach, will be talking about all things wealth. I'll tell you a little bit about him. He is very impressive. I'm a little bit partial.
Are you a girl fan?
A little bit biased, but he has come from very humble beginnings, but has really made a name for himself. He is a real estate investor. He is an entrepreneur. He loves to give back and mentor those, you know, really wants to help everyone, you know, no matter your background, find financial freedom and be able to retire without, you know, the stresses of, you know, the financial burdens that we're dealing with today. And he is also a travel enthusiast. He has been to 30 countries
30.
And counting, has some trips planned for later this year.
Yeah.
But he has also worked for a bank for many years, has dealt with $1 billion to date. I think that's very impressive. So
thanks, babe.
Without further ado, I will introduce you to Zach. Take it away, honey.
Thank you. Well, she says I'm impressive. I mean, this woman is impressive. How can anyone look like that and also be double certified in internal medicine and in BC medicine, which she just obtained recently? She has aspirations to pursue functional medicine. Functional medicine is absolutely new to me. I didn't know what it was, and I think that people should understand what that is. In addition to that, she also is interested in aesthetics. So Emily believes that through this podcast, why are we doing this? Because we want to empower people with a conversation that we have information on that you may not have. So peel back the curtain on healthcare and really put the onus on you, the listener. I think it's the most important thing for listeners to be in charge of their health and not leave that up to healthcare. In addition to that, we're also going to explore, you know, why doctors are leaving healthcare. In fact, that's the topic of this episode. Where have all the good doctors gone?
It's a great question.
Where have they gone? Hello. Where have they gone?
It's hard to find them.
Right?
It really is. Yeah.
So, over 50% of physicians have communicated that they are dissatisfied with their current job.
It's a big number.
And this might be relatable to someone I know. Mm-hmm. Does that relate to you?
It resonates. It does.
So, and the number one reason why doctors are dissatisfied with their job is 90% is because of the administration duties.
Administrative tasks.
Absolutely. Yeah. The administrative tasks. And so what we want to do today, this is an introductory episode. There's probably only two of you guys listening, but honestly, you know, hey, we got to start somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are some really good information. So by the end of this episode, you will understand exactly what's going on in healthcare. Why should you care? Well, you should care because the access of quality healthcare is not as available or will get worse over time. We predict over 100,000 physicians will leave by 2034. Is that what we were talking about yesterday?
Yeah, over the next 10 years, there's thought to be a huge deficit.
Absolutely.
Not just primary care providers, which is a huge portion of that, but yeah. Doctors in general, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll get more into that later. So, you know, I am going to look down at my guide here because I asked a bunch of questions. I want to make sure, you know, I stay on guide. So by the end of this episode, you'll have better information, start a conversation around what's going on in healthcare. So Emily, we all know you're a doctor, right? But why did you decide to get into medicine?
I think it was a combination of things, really. I was always very interested in math and science, or made me very good at it. You know, it came naturally to me. And so I thought that my profession would go in that realm to some degree. But I think, you know, some personal struggles or changes during adolescence and, you know, teenage years, my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and my mother was the youngest of five. She was the only daughter and very close with her mother. And so she moved in with us, and I saw all the struggles that my mom dealt with of, you know, being a caregiver and, you know, not being able to understand really the healthcare system and, you know, when to trust certain providers and really what to do and what decisions to make. And so I think it really made me want to become an advocate for my family and, you know, be able to take care of my parents as they got older. I wasn't really sure if that's the direction I wanted to go in. And so I worked as a medical scribe for a geriatrician before I even went to medical school, and really loved the relationship that he had with patients and, you know, being able to take care of the whole family. He saw, you know, parents and children and really grew with them. And I love that. And so I think I went into medical school knowing that I was going to be a primary care doctor. I knew that that's really where my path was going towards.
So it sounds like to me that you really wanted to help people. That's why you got into medicine.
Yeah, though I feel like I got into it for the right reasons, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about, you said your grandmother has Alzheimer's. So tell me about that. Like, how was the medical care? Like, what is one thing that sticks out to you that you remember and it's like, wow, I mean, this disease has progressed. And I know a lot of people listening, I mean, they probably have parents or grandparents or loved ones suffering from this disease. How did it impact you and your family?
It's a different beast than a lot of other chronic diseases because, you know, it's one thing to lose your physical health, but it's another thing to completely lose your memory and lose your mind. And I think I couldn't even imagine really what it would feel like to feel like I was locked in and not able to communicate or not able to remember, you know, where I was or what I did that day. And so I think it's, you know, coming from the actual patient perspective, but also from the family members. I mean, you know, you have family members that are taking care of their loved ones that have completely forgotten who they are. Their personalities completely change. And just seeing the stress that put on my mom and, you know, the amount of turmoil that she went through, wanting to make sure that she was doing the best for her mother, but also just being completely overwhelmed and, you know, really physically and emotionally exhausted.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounded like to me, you got into medicine to be a savior, to save people.
I don't know if I would say that. I think it was partially, you know, wanting to be able to take care of my family, but also...
So you wouldn't call that being a savior?
No, but I also had an interest in learning and solving problems. I enjoyed the challenge. I love to learn. You know, I love to learn. I enjoy, you know, going to conferences and learning new parts of healthcare.
Yeah.
I just love the pathophysiology, the anatomy of things. So I think it just suited my interests too.
Absolutely. So it sounds like to me you have a real passion for medicine. What went wrong?
I remember even in medical school, some of the older, kind of more seasoned physicians warned us not to go into medicine, honestly.
What? Wait a minute. So they were telling you not? By the way, if you guys are watching, those of you who are listening, we actually are. This is date night for us. So we have kombucha beers. Is that what it is?
Hard kombucha.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers. And so this is one of the privileges of being married to a doctor. You try different things, and they're 6%, I believe.
5%.
5%. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, that sucks us off track, but yeah. So
probably completely offsets the health benefits of kombucha, but
hey,
we're pretending to
right,
be healthy,
right? So yeah. So physicians were telling you that were teaching like this is you got to get out.
Yeah,
that's not good.
It's a little bit demoralizing.
Was it more than just?
I I think a lot of it at the time, it felt a little bit off-putting because you're already invested. I mean, to be able to get into medical school, you've already, you know, done all the prerequisites, you've done community service, you've gotten your letters of reference, you know, you've applied and interviewed and you're finally in med school and you've already put up this financial contribution too. I mean, if Absolutely. You're already in your first or second year, and honestly, you don't really get into the major clinical part of medicine until you're in your third or fourth year. And so you're working with these doctors who are kind of jaded and tell you that, you know, medicine's not what it used to be. And
what does that mean though? You said it twice. I don't know what that means.
Some of it at the time, I really perceived it as these are doctors who lived during the heyday of medicine, where medical sales reps or pharmaceutical companies were paying for vacations and
cars.
And obviously there are a lot more restrictions now, and that's not the case, which is a good thing. But the other thing too was electronic medical records. It was really starting to ramp up when I first went into medical school, and a lot of the doctors that I worked with were not really familiar with electronic medical record systems. They were, you know, hunting and pecking, you know, doing their best.
Do the 1-2s with their fingers.
And so I thought, you know, I didn't know what that medicine was, and I'm really adept at using electronic medical records and using the internet, so this isn't going to be a problem for me. But I think things, you know, were already starting to kind of show face back then. And they probably were right that things were changing for the worse.
Yeah. Something you said, you know, a lot of people may not know this, but you have 4 years of undergrad, mm-hmm. 4 years of medical school.
Yeah.
So that's 8 years. Mm-hmm. Then you told me about residency, mm-hmm. which is how long?
Depends on the specialty. For internal medicine, it's 3 years.
3 years.
Surgeons have longer residencies.
And then from there, if you want to specialize, you also have a specialty.
You go to fellowship.
And how long is fellowship, just on average?
It can be a year, 3 years.
3 years.
Just depending on, longer than that, depending on what your subspecialty is.
Got you. So it's 4 years, 4 years, which is 8. Then 3 years, which is 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 years.
It's a long time.
11 years. So when you were finished with residency, may I ask how old you are?
I am.
Not now, but how old were you when you finished?
I was in my 30s. Early 30s.
Wow. So I'll be honest with you guys. When I was in my 30s, I lived through my 20s. Like, I've been to 30 countries and counting. I lived it up. What did life look like for you? Honestly, what's a day in the life of having 11 years of school and training and all that? What does that look like?
It was very hard to have a social life. I missed out on a lot of weddings, birthdays, you know, Christmases. I remember spending or working Christmas Day in the hospital and being away from family, especially during residency. You're working 80-hour weeks. Really, you're just trying to get by, you know, waiting for that light at the end of the tunnel. Mm.
Wow. So when you went through all that schooling, when you're finally done and you're finally in your career, most people don't know this yet because we haven't dropped the bomb, but what was your moment of truth that you just felt like this is just not it for you? I mean, I know you, but like, people listening don't.
Yeah, it was a unique kind of experience because I finished residency at the start of the COVID pandemic. And so I was working in the ICU or admitting patients to the hospital really right after the pandemic had started. And there's this fear because we were hearing about, you know, young nurses that had no other health problems that were ending up on the ventilator because they were exposed to COVID, and we didn't have the masks that we were supposed to wear. We, you know, we didn't have the appropriate PPE, the personal protective equipment, everything. You know, there were supply chain shortages. And so before I even got into practice, I think there was this element of burnout, or, you know, what am I doing? Is this what I really want to do for the rest of my life? And then you get past that, and then you run into this, you know, the great resignation. Everybody's leaving, only medicine, but every other industry.
That's right.
And you're understaffed. I mean, even in the office, you think things are going to be easier. I'm not dealing with such high acuity patients, but you don't have enough.
Acuity.
So, you know, patients that are, have high needs that you see in the hospital or that you see in the
emergency room. Sorry, guys. I don't know if you're listening, but I didn't know what acuity was.
You see, it's a slower pace. So, you know, the office is definitely a slower pace than the hospital to a certain extent. I mean, it's still fast paced, but you don't see the patients typically aren't as sick when you're in the office. And we just didn't have the staff that we needed. And so all of that, when you don't have the staff, it falls to the people, the existing people that work there. And so you're just overworked, and, you know, you just reach burnout a lot faster. And I think the lack of staff, and then the increasing, you know, the other thing to think about as, you know, working as a primary care doctor for the post-COVID era, you're having to fill out a lot of paperwork for medical leave. A lot of people are sick with COVID.
And Wait a minute. So isn't the administration supposed to be doing that? Like, meaning, like, not the administration, but the people that work in the office?
Theoretically, yes. They're supposed to help with your message inbox and supposed to fill out forms. But when you don't have staff, you really, it's a collective effort. Everybody has to do what they can. And so a lot of people want work accommodations. A lot of people want to work from home. And so they want their primary care doctor to write them out of having to go into the office. And then they, if they're sick with COVID and they are out of work for a week or two, they need paperwork to be completed. And so you might not even be seeing the patient in the office, but you're having this inundation of messages through your message inbox. Patients now have direct contact with their physicians. They're able
and
to
send
direct
messages.
And that's
probably new. Like, when you were talking about your physicians, that medicine wasn't meant to be. Usually I would imagine you call the office and say, hey, I have this issue. Or do you not agree that that's probably what's changed?
Yeah, there's no filter, especially if you don't have the right infrastructure in your office with enough staff. The messages just go directly to the physician. Mm-hmm. And so you're in the exam rooms all day from 8 to 5:30, you know, depending on what your office hours are. A lot of physicians work completely through their lunch break, either seeing patients or charting. And then after you see all the patients, you've got all the paperwork. You don't have time to do that during the day. And so I think one of the recent statistics was for every 1 hour or every 1 hour you spend with patients, physicians spend 2 hours on administrative work, which it's crazy.
And it is crazy.
And women in general, there was a recent study that came out that showed that female physicians actually on average get 20%+ more messages from both staff and patients through electronic medical records.
What do you think is driving that?
I don't know. I don't know if patients and staff find females more approachable.
I can see that. I mean, you know, I think about the man and the woman psyche, right? Women are naturally more nurturers. Mm-hmm. I mean, not all cases, please don't send me hate mail. And men are more protectors and providers and things like that. And so I know we're harping on this, the moment of truth for you, but it sounds like to me you were seeing patients, you were doing paperwork, you have inbox. What's a day in a life? Like, did you have time to have, do you have lunches? Do you what does that look like?
If I had time to eat lunch, it was usually in front of my computer while I was, you know, dictating notes or answering messages. And I just got to the point where I was just depressed. I didn't have any time for self-care. We didn't have any time in our relationship together. You know, I was honestly, my health was the the worst it had ever been. I was the heaviest I'd ever been. I felt like I didn't really have time to exercise and eat right. And I just reached a breaking point. I felt like I was, if I continued on that path, it was, you know, the end result would not have been good.
Yeah. So tell me about your breaking point. Like, how did that feel for you? Did you feel like medicine, you went all this training, 11 years of training. Did that feel like it was fulfilling to you? Any moments of where you would just felt, man, I really don't want to do this anymore, or just self-doubt? Or like, yeah. What was your opportunity cost?
Yeah, I think that was the aha moment, because when you're going through medical school or when you're going through residency, you certainly, there are times where you're working more hours. I mean, there were weeks of nights where I worked more than 80 hours, and working nights can be really hard on the body. And so you think doing outpatient primary care, you're working more of a 8 to 5, 8 to 6, Monday through Friday. You don't have to work weekends or holidays. You're going to have the best life. Like that sounds real cush. That sounds nice.
Newsflash.
Yeah.
Did that happen?
And and then you get into it and it's like you're just spinning your wheels, because there's really no downtime during the day. At least sometimes when you're in the hospital, you know, you round on your patients in the morning, you have some downtime, you see your colleagues in the hallway, and there's some camaraderie right. when you're in the office, and you're just in and out of patient rooms all day. And there's also this anxiety that comes with that of not wanting your patients to feel like you've forgotten about them, and wanting to be on time, and wanting to spend time in the room with patients, but only having an allotted 15 minutes to address certain things. And it's just, you feel like you're not doing what you wanted to do. It just didn't feel like the medicine that I wanted to practice. And, and you think, I went through residency in medical school, and this is what my life is going to be like. Wow. I thought this was going to be better. And it just,
so tell me more about your depression. Like, what did that do to your psyche? And to, you know, you spent 11 years, and, you know, as a woman, like, I will be honest, that's probably hard. It's hard on your body. You know, most female physicians probably don't have kids until later. And so you sacrifice a lot to give back and to help people. You got a medicine for the right reasons. So tell me about the darkest time of your depression and what was going through your head at that time. And just tell the listeners about that.
We think about the opportunity costs, and we've talked about this a lot, just,
we have.
You know, for fertility in general. I mean, my mom went through early menopause at 35, and we've always, you know, we wanted a family, we wanted kids, right. and you never think when you're younger that, or at least I didn't think whenever I was younger that I was going to wait until my mid 30s to start having kids. I thought I'd have like a whole brood by now. And
oh, geez.
And you just find yourself putting it off and putting it off. I have so much respect for some of my peers who had kids during medical school and residency, because I just don't know how they did it. I mean, I could barely take care of myself and, you know, take care of each other with all the stress that we both dealt with work. And so we just, you know, kept putting it off. And
we've only been married for 2 years.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I can hear your ovaries clicking from here. And by the way, guys, as a side story, if you are listening to this, we are going to give you guys updates. But we are currently going through IVF.
We are.
And just having some insurance, and to make my wife happy. we're going through that. Let's just take a minute to talk about it. You know, are you cool with that?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Just like, it's not me, it's you. So you want to tell the listeners like how that process has been and where we are in the process right now?
It's not something that I ever really thought I would do, honestly. you know, wanting to be as natural as possible. And
I mean, bump and uglies.
but not, you know, there to a certain degree, it almost feels like playing God a little bit. Mm. And I feel like I've always kind of been uncomfortable with that. But I mean, I'm a doctor, and I'm, you know, a huge proponent of using the the advances in medicine.
I about to say, like, my thing is, like, we won't get into today, but, you know, when you say playing God, isn't, like, everyday medicine or surgery or chemo or whatever it is, yeah, isn't that playing God, technically?
Or, I mean, it's intervening. I don't know. I guess you just feel a little bit weird about, and not everybody feels this way, but I guess I just felt a little bit weird about IVF in general initially, until I learned a little bit more about it and obviously got older and wanted to be able to have kids. And I had, you know, had some testing done and realized that my numbers weren't as great as I hoped they would be. And so that was the catalyst. Oh. But it was a process, I think, for both of us, you know, being hopped up on hormones is not fun for either
it's
one of us.
It's not fun for me, I'll tell you that, you know, but at the end of the day, like, I just want to see you happy, and, you know, I want you to be fulfilled. I think being a mom is something that you've always wanted, and, you know, I want to give that to you, you know. And in speaking on this topic, where have all the doctors gone? I think some of the distractions that we've had in our relationship, just to be honest, you know, you quit your job and you're chained. You're chained to something that is so significant. You know, Emily has $250,000 of student loans, $250,000. And yes, people listening, like, oh, that was her choice. Yeah, it was her choice, you know, but her choice was to help people. It was not her choice to get into medicine, to be in the situation that she's in, and to compromise the quality of care that she can provide for her patients. So how does that feel? You know, I know we're talking about going back to your depression, but just those moments of just sitting there, you know, because there were some really rough times in our relationship. Like, we don't say the D word in our relationship. A lot of therapy has asked us not to say that. But honestly, we don't say the D word, but it was headed there. It was a lot. And so, you know, to tell the listeners about, you know, the profession and, yeah, you know, like how doctors feel and suicide rates and all that. Like, it's all relevant, I think.
Yeah, I know it's bad in primary care, but I think it's in every specialty right now. I think everybody's really dealing with it. And the most recent data has shown, I think it's 300 to 400 physicians a year die by suicide.
Oh my gosh.
And the most astonishing information that I learned was more with female physicians. So female physicians compared to their, you know, age matched counterparts in other professions, they have a 250 to 400% increase in suicide rate. And it's a real problem. You know, I think that we're not really seeing any improvement right now. If anything, the shortages are getting worse.
Right.
And
I feel like it's like a prison almost, because you have all this, you put your life on hold. Like, so check this out. You put your life on hold. You have $250,000 in student loan debt. You think things are going to get easier. They're getting harder. You do administrative work. You know, I'm summarizing what you said, and let me know if I'm completely wrong, but you work, you don't have lunches most of the time. You don't have breaks most of the time. You have a message inbox, you know, and all the things you want to provide the best quality care to your patients. And that gets in the way because everything else is you're juggling. You're constantly juggling act. I remember, like, we sleep in the same bed, you know, sleeping next to you and your phone's going off at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so it's just hard when you have all these things and then you have this $250,000. And I'll be honest, it's $35 a day to carry these loans.
The interest. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, do you regret becoming a doctor? I mean, these are a lot of things that are real issues.
I don't think I regret it. There were certainly times where I thought about it and I wondered if I'd taken a different path, if maybe it would have been better for me. But I think this has been a big learning opportunity. And
yeah, that's fair.
And just because, you know, I had, you know, 3 years of 3+ years of primary care out of residency that
right.
gave me the opportunity to meet a lot of great people and form friendships and find mentors. And it's just shown me what my passions are. And yeah. I'm still passionate about health and patient care. And I love to help people improve their metabolic health and help people lose weight and help people come off of medications. I'm a huge proponent of functional medicine. I think there's definitely a place for functional medicine and traditional medicine to interact, and I think that's really the sweet spot. So I look at this as a stepping stone and a way to pursue my passions, my career passions, my career goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see that. So, I'm not someone that's familiar with functional medicine. So maybe you can open that door. What does functional medicine? I think it's exciting that instead of cowering and buckling, and we are let's be honest, we are in a very good financial situation where you can take a break, and you can. And a lot of people can't. A lot of doctors that are listening are probably just can't take a break. And we'll get into that in just a moment. There's some options that we want to lay out for people that people may not even know about. But yeah, let's talk about functional medicine. So I guess that's what's next for you, huh?
Yeah, I really would love to incorporate it. So functional medicine, they describe the field as an approach, a biology-centered systems approach to finding the root cause. And the focus is more on lifestyle adjustment, using food as medicine.
These are things that you probably believe, right?
Movement, food. Activity. Yes, I think there's a big place for education and really legislative change, because we see the foods that people have access to, the ultra-processed foods, the way that
and they're
foods
cheap.
Are handled. Yeah.
I mean, health and wealth, from a financial perspective, they're cheap.
They are. They are.
And they taste really good.
They're really driving our health collectively as a population into the ground. And I think where there's some controversy is sometimes there's a divide where people will fully go down that path of alternative medicine, where they are completely against medications. And,
right.
And I think there's a place for both.
I do too.
I think that people who are undergoing cancer treatment, working with an alternative medicine specialist or doing some of those integrative therapies along with their chemo and radiation significantly improves quality of life and can help them tolerate those treatments better. And just the prevention standpoint, being able to prevent things like diabetes and metabolic syndrome by using food as medicine to fuel your body and avoid going on those medications and having the complications of those chronic diseases, I think is very powerful.
I think so too. And I think you want to talk to people about, what you have developed. It's on our website, suitsandscrubspodcast.com. You developed a free offer for everyone. You want to talk about that a little bit, about food as medicine? I think so Emily really wants to be the gut doctor and the hormone doctor, which we'll talk about in a minute. You want to talk to people about what that guide is and why is that so important?
I have really gotten into some research on the gut microbiome, and I know it's a growing field in really every aspect of medicine. Initially we were thinking more specifically the GI system and how the gut microbiome impacts your gut health, but immunity, inflammatory responses, insulin resistance, there are some studies that are showing an impact on mood, anxiety and depression and stress responses with a gut microbiome that is, it's good to have a varied microbiome, so have a lot of different types of good bacteria in your gut versus only having a few. And I created just a kind of a simple handout to tell you what is involved in your gut microbiome, how to feed it appropriately, how to make it more varied, and I have a full 7-day meal plan to kind of help reset the gut too, you know, potentially help reset your hormones. And
by the way, guys, we are doing it right now.
We are.
And honestly, I'm like 7 days in and I have never felt more clear. I've never slept better. I ran over 40 miles this month, you know, and I'm working like insane. I work my job and then I do other things. Like we do other things too. And so I can't say enough how much my outlook on life has changed. You know, we stopped drinking, but yeah, we're having a few drinks tonight. In fact, I cracked one earlier if you didn't hear that. you know, I love that sound. But yeah, so tell us about the pitfalls of, you know, traditional medicine with this new wave of functional medicine and how this kind of, you touched on it earlier. But anything else you want just the people to know? You know, what are the pitfalls with everyday medicine and how can people really react to what you're saying? You know, with you know, exiting doctors and just having that behind the curtain view.
Yeah. I mean, in medical school and residency, we learned that there needs to be a shift away from kind of the what we call the paternalistic, you know, model for medicine, where it used to be the doctors just told you what you were supposed to do and you just followed it. And, you know, you took their recommendations, you didn't ask questions. And now it's supposed to be more a shared partnership. You're supposed to be able to educate your patients and decide, you know, yes, you can educate them on how to improve their health and avoid chronic diseases, but it also, you know, what are their drives? What are their motivations? And what are their deficits? What do they need to learn? And it's more of an individualized approach. And unfortunately, with the shortages of not only doctors, but nurses and other healthcare providers, it feels like it's turning into an assembly line. We just don't have the time in the traditional primary care model to really sit down and talk to patients and educate them. And it's just trying to put out fires. It's like playing a game of whack-a-mole. Yeah, that's really what I feel like my day-to-day felt like, because you'd have, especially after the COVID pandemic, you'd have patients that came in that hadn't been seen by anyone in 3 years, and they schedule an annual physical, but they really want to talk about 5 different health problems at the same time, and you can't talk about all of those things without then pushing the rest of your schedule back 30 plus minutes, and then everybody else is pissed off at you because you're running late for their appointment. And I just don't see it getting better unless there are some significant changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a lot in my Facebook feed, I see a lot of people complain in the waiting room. I'm waiting forever. And the number one catalyst that I've seen is like the doctors. I don't think that's fair. You know, you have to see patients every 15 minutes. Sometimes they come in for an annual physical and then they want to talk about a health problem. Like, how does that work with insurance and billing and all that?
That's the other thing. It's hard to navigate that when you get out of training as well, because you don't really learn a lot about the billing and
but, coding. But why would you need to know the billing? I'm sorry, I'm interrupt, but why would you need to know the billing and coding?
Well, now physicians have to do their own billing and coding.
What?
Wait
a minute. So you have to do your own billing and coding now? Mm-hmm. My mom she worked in healthcare for 25, 35 years. And so I know a lot about this just because being raised around it. That is not easy.
Yeah, it's not easy because sometimes it feels like there's some gray area. Technically, you're supposed to double charge someone if they come in for a preventative visit, like a physical, and they also want to talk about concerns.
Like, how do you stop that, though? So if someone comes, like, I'll be honest, I come in for a physical, and I say, hey, I have this issue. I want to talk to you about it. You know, I don't know how I feel if my primary care doctor would, like, because a physical doesn't cost anything through insurance, but they talked about that, and then I have a copay afterwards. Talk to me about that. That's just weird. Yeah. And the doctor's like responsible for that? Almost seems like a conflict of interest. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, it can be hard because it's a double-edged sword. You can't really pick and choose who you're going to double charge and who you're not going to double charge. And then, you know, you're technically being fraudulent if you don't charge someone by when you're talking about several, you know, chronic conditions or other health problems during their physicals, because, you know, insurance will only wants to pay for a certain thing. So it's all a mess.
Yeah.
The whole system is a mess.
Yeah. I wouldn't say every single system is this way, but I guarantee you that people don't know that when you have an annual physical and then you have other medical problems and you want to bundle those together. I guarantee you people just don't know that. So what advice would you give people who are going for an annual physical but also have medical issues? To me, an annual physical is, yeah, you do that, but you should have a conversation with your doctor to check up on health.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a right answer. Some people don't mind being double billed if their insurance is, you know, if they're just paying a minimal copay, but if it's someone who's living paycheck to paycheck and they don't have very high insurance coverage, then it might be a significant financial burden on someone. So I think just being familiar with your health benefits can be really helpful going into things, kind of knowing what you want to talk about and what's covered and what's not covered. But I think there's also this new system called value-based care, where it's, you know, it's more based on the outcomes of the patient and their numbers and not necessarily a fee for service kind of model that might gain some traction and might be beneficial in the long run.
Like value care. So what does that mean? Like people are incentivized to have better scores on their health.
So
your insurance goes down. Like what is that? I don't know what that means.
You're able to I guess spend more time and effort on patients, especially those with high complexity that have a lot of health problems, to keep them out of the hospital. They'll reimburse you more to keep those people out of the hospital or out of the emergency room instead of seeing more patients, because, you know, hospital fees and emergency room fees are very costly, especially for the patient or insurance company.
Absolutely. So if we just summarize this conversation, what do you think the top five, six, whatever things are, the reason why doctors, where have all the doctors gone? What are the top five or six things, based upon this conversation, summarized are? So number one, I would say, is burnout, for sure.
Yeah.
Probably the number one.
The burnout in general, the, you know, disgruntled patients or the lack of trust, especially after the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, healthcare was very politicized at that point. Yeah, and so you have a lot of division in health decisions too. And that does not make a physician's job any easier.
No, it doesn't.
We already, you know, obviously talked about the administrative tasks as a huge, huge reason. Just lack of appreciation and support from your administration.
I say from everyone, yeah. It sounds like.
Lack of control over your own schedule. Mm-hmm. Insurance companies, fighting with insurance companies for coverage of certain medications.
So tell me about that. So insurance, like how does insurance play into care?
Everybody has different insurance and every plan is different.
Right.
So it's difficult to navigate in that way.
Yeah.
Because it's not a cookie cutter approach.
Right.
And you can't, it's hard to predict whose insurance is going to cover this and whose isn't. And especially with the craze of these weight loss medications like the Wegovy Mounjaro or Zepbound, going through that process of getting insurance to approve the medication or not approve the medication, it's a very long, drawn-out process, and the patient gets upset with us because they're still waiting for the medication to get approved, and if the medication gets denied, there's a lack of understanding of, you know, is it the office's fault? Did the office drop the ball on something? There's just a lot of hoops to jump through just to get the best possible medication prescribed for your patient.
Yeah.
And diagnostic testing too.
Yeah, absolutely. Has there ever been a situation where you prescribe something to a patient and, you know, the insurance is like, absolutely not?
Oh, all the time. Or they must try XYZ first before we'll agree to cover this.
So who is driving care?
Insurance companies have a huge, you know, a huge hand in that.
Yeah. So what do you do in a situation where you do feel very strongly? Well, first of all, how do you have the time? You know, that's the number one. Like, you go through all this. How do you have the time to ensure that insurance agrees or approves something that you really strongly believe that your patient needs? And then what does that look like?
Sometimes you have to fill out paperwork.
Some more paperwork.
Yeah. Sometimes it's extensive paperwork. Other times you have to do peer-to-peer reviews where you actually talk to a provider who works for the insurance company, and they ask you a bunch of questions about why it's necessary to get this test. So you have to find the time in your schedule to be able to call this person and basically argue your case about why you think this patient that you saw personally in the office needs a CT scan or an MRI. Mm. And you're arguing it with someone who's never seen the patient, who doesn't know them personally or truly know their background. They're just seeing the patient.
So wait. Are you kidding me? So you're saying that you had to find time in your schedule to talk to a doctor mm-hmm. on the other side that is employed by this insurance company and argue your case? Mm-hmm. What? What? Like, how successful is that most of the time?
Generally, I am not an excessive user of diagnostic tests if they're not needed. And so when I have a peer-to-peer review, I almost always get it covered.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's comforting.
But it's still a process. It's still extra time.
Right. Right. And I hate to say this, and I'm not saying this is true. So again, don't send me hate mail. But with the doctors going through the turn and burn, they see patients every 15 minutes. Like, sometimes, you know, based on our conversation, they shadow book patients where they think that a patient won't show up. So they'll put another patient on your schedule. So it puts you more behind because the office has to meet a certain number. And this is the business side of me. I know exactly how that works. I'm looking directly into the camera and I'm not knocking the administration. I'm just saying, that sucks. And so, like, how does that all play a factor?
It's just another piece that is forcing doctors to leave. It's not one thing. I think it's all things. And maybe COVID was the last straw. And people are just not wanting to put up with it anymore.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, you're chained to your student loans. You know, I mean, you and I are relatively the same age, right? And so I just want to walk people through a journey. And I have spent a lot of my time, and I'll talk about this in the next episode, and growing your skill sets. I have no student loans. I'm not bragging when I say this. I only went to 4 years of college. I have many certifications and things like that. I've traveled the world. I have lived life like most people have not lived. I'm not saying this to brag again. And you, on the other hand, by the time I was 30, but you, on the other hand, went through all this training, all this compromise, sacrifice, spent Christmases alone, missed out on birthdays. Your friends are getting engaged. Your friends are having babies, you know, and here you are. And now you're into this career. You have $35 a day on your interest and your student loans. I mean, and you quit your job. I think I'm winning. No, I'm serious. You know, it's, I say that jokingly, but if we don't address this in common healthcare, and yes, it starts with a conversation, it's only going to get worse. And who suffers? You guys listening, you guys suffer because the access to quality care goes down and down and down and down. And so, you know, I know you personally, you know, Emily has, and we'd probably show a roll of this, one of the highest patient satisfaction scores, over 140, 150, I believe, 4.9 rating. You know, some of these, I'm not just saying this because she's my wife. I'm just saying this because I know what kind of person she is. She really cares. And taking that extra time and all that has really put a toll. She cared so much, it put a strain on our relationship. We almost dropped the D word, you know. Em had a few nervous breakdowns. She told me not to talk about it, but honestly, it happened. And you had to take a leave of absence. You know, you want to tell the listeners about where you were in that headspace? And just, you know, I would come home and I would open up the door and she would just be crying. And I hate to say this, but after like a year of it, I just say, oh, Emily's crying again. And I'm not a bad husband for saying that. I hope I'm not. But it was just so frequent. It was just like, get out of it. You know, and that really is the situation that you were in. It was just really hard to watch you struggle like that because, you know, I know you're a perfectionist and I know you want to do a good job and you want to help everyone. And, you know, there's that one patient you got to do this with and do that with. And she could never let it go. She could never turn it off. She always was thinking about her inbox and her calls. And so I just want to leave that with people like a real life example of where have all the good doctors gone? Emily's gone. She left.
Yeah, it's not a unique story. I think it's happening everywhere. And unfortunately, there were patients that established with me that I was already their third or fourth primary care doctor. They'd been left behind by multiple already. And that's the worst part of it, I think, leaving the patients behind. I had a hard time with that.
I know you did.
But
I know you did. There's some patients out there.
You got to take care of
your own
health and well-being too. And
that's right.
If you don't feel like you're being valued and you're not enjoying your life to the fullest, you got to make some changes.
That's right. I'm proud of you. So the last question I have for you is, what can we do? What do you recommend? You know, the doctors that are currently living this, you know, what are you exploring? What are you looking into? What advice can you give to the people that are listening that may be doctors or not just doctors, but healthcare workers? Like, what advice? I mean, obviously you have a husband, you know, it's a sugar daddy right now, you know, but to me, my wife's happiness is far more important to me than, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think awareness is key. Just people knowing the condition of the healthcare system right now and having a little bit of grace.
Grace
is definitely helpful. You might be waiting 20 or 30 minutes to see your doctor, but I can promise you that they wish they could spend more time with you and they're overworked and burned out.
Yeah.
And it's often not their choice to be seeing as many patients as they're seeing. It's just the nature of the beast right now. There aren't enough doctors to go around.
Yeah. There's not. I think, you know, we're living in the metropolis. So if you're listening to this in other cities, you know, maybe you don't have access to quality care, or maybe, you know, you take 2 or 3 months to find a doctor. You know, it is tough out there. And so I know, Em is exploring, you know, additional specialties just to explore her passions and see if she can approach medicine from a different perspective. And so we're just going to share that journey with you guys to just kind of see, you know, we thought about buying a practice. We thought about opening a practice. There's a lot of big barriers to entry, which is just a fancy business way of saying is really fucking hard with investments and all of that, systems and insurance and politics. And the insurance alone, I think it would cost us about $1.5 million to open up a wellness center. And we looked into that and off the table, but we're just going to explore and just see what people think. So if there's anything in this episode that you guys enjoyed, I know it's an introduction episode. It probably wasn't the most fascinating. You probably don't care about who we are, but we just wanted to share our story with you guys just so you understand exactly who we are, what we represent, and what we're trying to provide. So drop us a comment, suitsandscrubspodcast.com. Get in touch with us. Ask a question. You know, let's start a conversation. That's all that we want. So with that said, we'll leave you guys out. So a little bit of wealth.
A little bit of health.
And a lot of love.
Thank you guys for listening.
Absolutely. So on next time, our next episode will be my journey. We'll talk about fire movement, which is really exciting. So if you're not interested in finance, I really think you should listen, but that's okay. And also a method that I employed of how I saved enough for retirement that I do not have to put any more money into retirement. And I'm not even 40 yet. So I'd love to help other people do that. I'm not special. I just learned the system. So, all right, guys. Bye.
He's on the hustle, she's on the grind. There's no time to kill. For saving lives and new deadlines, and there's some holes to fill. With a little health and a little wealth and a lot of love, that's a life that we live. Suits and scrubs.